Hello, my name is Lily, and today I will be reading Fortune Magazine for the Talking Information Center. This is the December 2025/January 2026 edition of Fortune Magazine. Specifically, it is volume 192, number 3. And we are starting off with this article titled, How an AI Bubble Could Ruin the Party. This is written by Jim Edwards. NVIDIA's Jensen Huang says he doesn't believe we're in an artificial intelligence bubble. Amazon's Jeff Bezos says we probably are in one. OpenAI's Sam Altman, the human face of the AI boom, has also invoked a bubble, adding, quote, I do think some investors are likely to lose a lot of money. This, in a nutshell, is the narrative of the entire global stock market right now, and the conundrum that no tech CEO or asset manager can avoid addressing. Is AI a bubble or not? Much is at stake. Since the current bull market began in October 2022, roughly 75% of gains in the S&P 500 have come from just 7 stocks: Alphabet, Apple, Amazon, Meta, Microsoft, Nvidia, and Tesla. Those companies, known as the Magnificent 7, have a combined market cap of about $21.5 trillion as of mid-November. Their strategies, Apple's perhaps accepted, are heavily dependent on AI. But if AI does not deliver the revenues or the efficiencies that big tech experts, the fallout in stocks will likely be severe, because the world's investable assets are currently concentrated in AI and AI-adjacent stocks to an unprecedented degree. The S&P 500 has risen 14.7% this year, repeatedly breaking new record highs. But 40% of the index's value comes from the 10 biggest stocks within it, all but one of those of which are tech companies. Most of those companies, in turn, are pouring vast sums into AI for the development of new data centers, large language models, and the massive amounts of electricity they guzzle. Goldman Sachs estimates that capital expenditure on AI will hit $390 billion this year and increase by another 19% in 2026. Bank of America is even more bullish. It projects that AI capex will hit $1.2 trillion in 2030. The recipients of the lion's share of that money are 10 AI companies that are interlocked with one another as customers and investors in an increasingly circular way, as a recent research note from Morgan Stanley described it. That note referenced relationships between OpenAI, NVIDIA, Oracle, Microsoft, CoreWeave, and AMD, involving billions in equity stakes, revenue sharing, vendor financing, and repurchase agreements being passed back and forth among them. On one level, that's normal. Most industries feature a collection of companies that do business with one another. The problem in AI is that the revenues currently being generated by AI companies are far smaller than the amount of capex being directed at them and the Magnificent Seven. The back-of-the-envelope math is harsh. AI capex coming from tech companies listed in the S&P 500 is $400 billion or more per year going forward. The biggest AI company, OpenAI, the maker of ChatGPT, has disclosed revenues of just $13 billion for 2025. Altman recently said revenues were, quote, well more than that, hinting they may hit $100 billion in 2027. But that's still nowhere near the level of capex it's committing to. OpenAI may have lost $12 billion in the third quarter of 2025 alone, according to the disclosure by Microsoft, which has a 32.5% stake in the company. Yet, it has committed to spending $1.4 trillion to develop its product, and it is valued by its venture capital and other investors at $500 billion. These numbers don't add up, and won't until the massive AI rollout starts to yield real financial benefits. Quote, that is exactly the discussion in the market at the moment. Can the 10 AI companies generate enough revenue to justify the capex, says Torsten Slok, chief economist at Apollo Global Management. If the answer to that question is no, or more relevantly, not soon enough to satisfy investors' expectations about the future, then the fallout in global equities could be brutal. Take, for instance, the Russell 2000, an index of small-cap U.S. companies. 806 of them, or about 40%, have no earnings or negative earnings. Counterintuitively, the stocks of unprofitable Russell companies have outperformed those that actually make money this year, or made money this year, according to Apollo. Most of those unprofitable companies are tech firms riding the AI narrative. With the Magnificent Seven dominating large-cap stocks and money-losing small-caps soaring from optimism around AI, any reversal in sentiment will be widespread, especially if it's triggered by softening in AI infrastructure spending, and the broader repercussions in equity markets could be even greater. Since 1990, U.S. assets of all kinds, stocks, bonds, property, you name it, have become increasingly dominant globally. U.S. stocks now account for about 60% of the valuation of all stocks on the planet, according to Christian Mueller Glissman, Goldman Sachs Managing Director and Head of Asset Allocation Research. And technology stocks represent about 45% of all U.S. stocks, worth $26 trillion or more at the close of October, according to S&P Global. In other words, most of the world's assets currently look like an upside-down pyramid, teetering on its point. The wide base at the top consists mostly of U.S. equities. Underneath that, the performance of those equities is driven by just 7 public tech companies. Those 7 companies are funding 10 or so much smaller private AI companies upon whose fortunes they currently rely. And those AI companies, at the very bottom of the inverted triangle, are largely unprofitable. For that reason, owning the S&P 500 via an exchange-traded fund, traditionally one of the safest and most common bets for smaller retail investors, isn't providing the diversification it used to. Today, it's largely a bet on a few globally massive tech platforms, concentrating millions of people's retirement savings toward the tip of that pyramid. The world's dependence on U.S. equities stems in part from the fact that the U.S. is simply the largest economy in the world, says Mueller Glissman, making the concentration a proportional reflection of economic reality. But it also means that if U.S. equities are in a bubble, then the whole world is in a bubble, whether we like it or not. The reason U.S. stocks have become so much bigger than foreign stocks is that the U.S. has a heavier concentration of finance and tech stocks compared with the rest of the world, Mueller Glissman adds. Those sectors enjoy a high degree of operating cost leverage, or the ability to increase revenues without adding many new staff or resources. An app with 200 million users doesn't have anywhere close to twice the running costs of an app with 100 million users, but if a gold mining company wants to double its capacity, it pretty much needs to double its costs in equipment and labor. America has an enormous amount of this financialization, Mueller Glissman says. That makes the argument a bit more scary in the sense that this world portfolio is getting more and more important for the global economy in terms of driving wealth effects and in terms of driving financial conditions. So, for the next 12 months, investors will stay closely tuned to the revenue picture in AI. For now, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Apollo, and Bank of America have all either published research or told Fortune directly that they expect CapEx growth for AI to continue unabated through 2026. The bubble has a way to go, in other words. The advice, as always, is to sell, but not right now. For some concrete investing ideas, see the following pages. At some point, the tide will go out and stock investors, venture capital firms, and big tech's AI capex hyperscalers will all want to know who has a viable business and who is swimming naked, according to Lisa Shallet, Morgan Stanley's wealth management chief investment officer. That, in turn, could be the catalyst for a much broader stock market reckoning. Shalit believes that the current period of American exceptionalism, in which U.S. companies and assets dominate the global economy, is due to unwind in what she calls a great rebalancing. And when that happens, she wrote in a recent note to clients, its impact won't be limited to companies with direct stakes in the AI boom. Since the financial crisis of 2008, Shalit argues, American stock market outperformance relative to the rest of the world has been supercharged by historic monetary policy intervention that kept interest rates near zero. Deficit spending and fiscal stimulus, including about $4.6 trillion in relief outlays at the height of the COVID pandemic, and the fruits of globalization, which were enhanced by the privilege of having the world's reserve currency. Those factors, Shalit believes, are likely to phase out over the next 5 to 10 years, with negative implications for U.S. stocks across the board. And that's where the AI bubble question takes on even more weight. Over the past year, sky-high projections about AI's economic benefits have helped investors ignore a steady flow of troubling economic indicators. If AI reality fails to live up to the hype, gloom could spread quickly. With global trade becoming more expensive under President Trump's tariffs, inflation now a semi-permanent feature of economic life, and the U.S. facing potential pressure from the bond market to balance its fiscal books, investors are unlikely to be generous if they detect that reliable earnings per share growth has been replaced by speculative folly. Quote, people realize that there's only so much of the story that you can price into the future without the show-me-the-money moment, Shalit tells Fortune. We think we're pretty close to the moon already. And if asset values come back down to earth, the challenge will be to avoid burning up on re-entry. Next up is this article by Jeff Colvin titled, How to Invest Like Warren Buffett. And previously we read a little bit of this, but I'll start from the beginning just because we had only read about the first paragraph, so we'll continue on. History's greatest masterclass on investing is about to shut down. On December 31st, Warren Buffett will hand over the Berkshire Hathaway CEO job to Vice Chairman Greg Abel. Now, as Buffett's 60 years of running Berkshire come to an end, it's time to assess his performance. Brace yourself. If you had put $1,000 into the S&P 500 index at the beginning of those 60 years, you'd now have $441,196, a tremendous reward for doing nothing. But if you had put your $1,000 into Berkshire stock, you would now have a truly incredible $59,681,063. Another way to think of it, if you had invested $20,000 back then, you would today be a billionaire, without doing a thing. As astonishing as the numbers are, another facet of Buffett's career is at least as remarkable. Through it all, he has happily, exuberantly told the world exactly how he does it. He holds no investing secrets. In speeches, interviews, and his annual letters to Berkshire shareholders, he has explained what he looks for, what he ignores, and how he thinks. Buffett bought his first stock, City Service Preferred, the oil and gas company known today as Citgo, when he was 11 years old, and he will retire at age 95. So here, we offer 84 years of investment wisdom, condensed and explained. Buffett's five top rules of investing. Rule number one, don't even try to pick stocks like Buffett. Stick with an S&P 500 index fund plus some short-term treasures. Buffett has insisted for decades it's the best way for average investors to invest. Few can spend many hours a week analyzing stocks. Buying managed mutual funds in which professionals choose stocks may seem a good alternative, but it isn't. Research has long found that over 10-year spans, most managed funds underperform the market. A few managed funds still outperform the market over the long run, but they aren't the same funds from decade to decade, and identifying the few winners in advance has proved impossible. But Buffett's solution? Put 90% of your portfolio into buying the market. By regularly investing in a broad index fund, Buffett has said, quote, the know-nothing investor can actually outperform most investment professionals. The other 10% of your portfolio should be in short-term treasury bills as a steady cash buffer, so you needn't sell stocks if you unexpectedly require money. But suppose you're absolutely set on following Buffett and discovering fantastic individual stocks. He has said if you are a non-professional investor who likes spending 6 to 8 hours a week working on investments, then do it, though Buffett works on it more than 8 hours every day. In that case, rule number two, if you're going to pick stocks, don't pick many of them. The more stocks you buy, the more your portfolio starts to look like the market. Buffett's portfolio as of June 30th, 2025, most recent data, was worth $257 billion, and just four stocks, Apple, American Express, Bank of America, and Coca-Cola, accounted for 63% of the portfolio's value. That's risky, which is the point. Successful stock pickers must summon the courage to invest large amounts of money into a few stocks. Buffett, blunt as always, has said, quote, diversification is protection against ignorance. It makes little sense if you know what you're doing. A corollary is that you shouldn't expect to make many picks in your whole life. I always tell the students in business school they'd be better off when they get out of business school to have a punch card with 20 punches on it, he once told an audience at Notre Dame. And every time they made an investment decision, they used up one of those punches. The reality, he said, was that, quote, they aren't going to get 20 great ideas in their lifetime. They're going to get 5 or 3 or 7, and you can get rich off 5 or 3 or 7. Rule number three. Buy stocks you'd be happy owning if you knew the stock market would close for 10 years. That's a measure of your confidence. It's also a reminder to think long-term. No companies, not even Buffett's forever stocks, can evade mistakes and unpredictable shocks that send a stock plunging. Yet, through ups and downs, he has held Coca-Cola for 37 years, American Express for 34 years, Bank of America for 14 years, and Apple for 9 years. Steadily profiting from the rebounds that followed their stumbles. Arguably the most inspiring example of staying with a stock through ups and downs is Berkshire Hathaway itself. Its stock underperformed the S&P in 6 of its first 11 years. Some original stockholders might have felt that was more excitement than they wanted and sold their shares, but those who held on are rich. Buffett says he knows of Berkshire stockholders, unheard of by the public, who are billionaires entirely from holding their shares for decades. Rule number four. Invest in companies with a moat, a durable competitive advantage. It can be a powerful worldwide brand, like American Express, or low costs, Geico, which Berkshire owns entirely, and the moat must be widening over time. That's because, as Buffett says, quote, competitors will repeatedly assault any business castle that is earning high returns. In his quest for wide-moated castles, he rules out entire industries that are, quote, prone to rapid and continuous change, he says. Still, every industry changes eventually, sometimes in ways that drain a moat dry. For example, in 1986, Berkshire bought World Book Encyclopedia, which Buffett said had a real moat, with its powerful brand. By 1995, with CD-ROMs and then the internet rising, he was calling it Berkshire's biggest problem. Berkshire still owns the business, but it's nothing like the profit machine Buffett had hoped for. A reminder that no one bats 1,000. Rule number 5. Be greedy when others are fearful, and fearful when others are greedy. That may be Buffett's most famous advice. It seems so obvious, but following it requires more courage than most people possess. Latest example, United Health Group, America's largest health insurer and healthcare company. Its stock plunged from a near all-time high of $600 to $312 in this year's second quarter. And during that quarter, government disclosures don't say exactly when, Berkshire bought 5 million shares. Now, in the Buffett system, it's time to be patient. One more thing. regular investors actually have an advantage over the greatest investor of all time. Those five rules are sound and proven. They'll greatly help anyone who follows them over time. But it must be said, follow all those rules religiously for years, get rich, and your chances of approaching Buffett's astounding record will still be near zero. That's because he had an extremely early head start, and if your age is in double digits, you're already behind. Buffett's childhood obsession with making money, which began around age five, produced more than charming stories. By his teens, he was accumulating serious business savvy and grown-up capital that enabled him to keep investing, accruing more gains, and investing more. As his biographer, Alice Schroeder, wrote in The Snowball, Warren Buffett and the Business of Life, no one else in high school was a businessman. He delivered newspapers, 500,000 in total, he later calculated, bought refurbished golf balls and sold them at a profit, sold sets of stamps to collectors, invested in farmland and shared the earnings with a tenant farmer. He bought a pinball machine with a friend and put it in a barber shop, then bought another machine with the money from the first one, and then bought still more. By age 16, he had $5,000, which is about $78,000 in today's money. Unlike most of us, he knew by then that investing would be his life's work, and he was well on his way. If you're starting to feel inadequate comparing your own pathetic self against Buffett, cheer up. He has a comforting observation for you. You needn't be a Mensa member to invest brilliantly. Buffett's IQ, never publicly stated, is rumored to be 150. If so, that means he's smarter than 99.9957% of the population. But, he has said, quote, "You don't need a lot of brains to be in business. What you do need is emotional stability. You have to be able to think independently." And yes, Buffett envies you. In one way, and probably only one way, you have an advantage over him. To move the needle when adding to his colossal stock portfolio, he must buy gigantic volumes of a company's shares, and pushing mountains of money toward one stock raises the price before he can buy all the shares he wants at the price he found so alluring. You, however, are almost certainly not moving markets. As an investor, he told Businessweek in 1999, it's, quote, "a huge structural advantage to not have a lot of money. I think I could make you 50% a year on $1 million. No, I know I could. I guarantee that." Berkshire shareholders have never needed to study Buffett's investing magic. They could just buy Berkshire stock and let him do the work with spectacular results. But that option evaporates on January 1st, 2026, leaving the great question, is Berkshire Hathaway so immersed in Buffett's way of investing that his successors will carry it on institutionally? Or is Buffett unique in so many ways that Berkshire can never hope to continue his staggering performance? Buffett's 1977 letter to shareholders may suggest an answer. He described the criteria of a truly great, enduring business as understood by him and his longtime business partner, Charlie Munger. The criterion of enduring, he wrote, quote, "eliminates the business whose success depends on having a great manager. Of course, a terrific CEO is a huge asset for any enterprise, but if a business requires a superstar to produce great results, the business itself cannot be deemed great." Buffett is obviously a superstar, and it's hard to see any inherent factors other than Buffett that made Berkshire Hathaway so hugely successful. He seems to have chosen excellently with Abel and Berkshire's other top executives, but the world won't know how good they really are until they're on their own. Has Buffett picked a successor as superbly as he picks stocks? After 60 years, it's the hardest call Berkshire shareholders have ever had to make. And now, with our last couple of minutes for today's reading of Fortune, I will go through the nation's top professionals. And this next person is named Fatima Donia Milly, MD, PhD, and she is a medical epidemiologist for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention based in Atlanta, Georgia. Affiliated with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, since 1991, Dr. Fatima Donia Milly has more than 35 years of professional expertise in epidemiology and medicine. Recognized as a medical epidemiologist, she joined the CDC after graduating from the prestigious CDC Epidemic Intelligence Service postdoctoral program and has since been met with much success. She is noteworthy for studying the causes, distributions, and control of various diseases in human populations, particularly in the areas of epidemiology, genetics, internal medicine, and pediatrics. Along with her current appointment, Dr. Milly has served as a senior medical epidemiologist and a mentor in epidemiology and surveillance in the Division of Global HIV and Tuberculosis at the CDC since 2016. Engaged in significant research, Dr. Milly is widely regarded for her research into health disparities experienced by racial and ethnic minorities and underserved communities across the nation. Impressively, her work, in collaboration with the Morehouse School of Medicine, aided the U.S. Congress in addressing healthcare inequity in 2000. 20 years later, during the emergency of the COVID-19 pandemic, Dr. Milly played a crucial role by leading teams of skilled epidemiologists and statisticians in providing domestic vaccination data for developing national vaccine programs and informed COVID-19 policy decisions. Earlier in her career, Dr. Milly served as a medical epidemiologist in the Division of Blood Disorders at the CDC for 7 years, where she also trained junior scientists in biostatistics and epidemiology. Her expertise extended to Emory University and the Morehouse School of Medicine, where she held teaching appointments. Notably, she was also an instructor for the Epidemic Intelligence Service Summer Course and the Epidemiology in Action courses at the CDC, demonstrating her aptitude for sharing her breadth of knowledge with the broader community. And this bio does keep going, but that is all the time we have for right now in this reading of Fortune Magazine. Thank you so much for listening to the Talking Information Center, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.